podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is the Anfield wrap after Liverpool have gone to Old Trafford and won 5-0. I am joined by Rob Gutman, Josh Sexton and Stu Wright. Maria Eagle will be joining us remotely to talk about Hillsborough Law, but we are going to start off talking about Manchester United 0, Liverpool 5. Rob, I've had a long morning trying to work out how to open this show. Whether it should just be, or I've just done it very straight, because there's part of me that just wants to do laughter. There's part of me that wants to come up with some sort of witty one-liner to pull out the bag and all of that sort of stuff. There's all the puns around fives and all of that, but
I missed the rapping.
I had a little think about that, but we're not going to do that either, because I just think you've got to luxuriate in it, Rob. It simply does not get better than this. It's probably the best regular away win in Liverpool's modern history, to say the least. The most regular in the season league away win, the greatest one. It was absolutely everything you want from a football match, including being able to laugh for the last half an hour.
I'm off for the big shout that says things like Watford away, I think last week I said was the greatest Liverpool performance of the modern era or something. But you're looking at that and going, that might have been it, fucking hell. But I actually don't know how to deal with things when they get this good in football. And I'm going to need a few days here, so I'm going to apologise. I'm troubled by all kinds of it. It's when life gets too good, maybe it's just a terrible personality flaw, I think. Now something shit's going to happen, isn't it? Yeah, what's the word? Imposter syndrome, I think a psychiatrist would say. But the gloat even, I'm sitting there sort of enjoying it and wanting to get involved, but slightly wincing at the gloat. I never forget, and I'm going to say this as a note of caution, but this is just the nature of football. I remember being involved in the biggest, always look on the bright side of life, gloat at Man United. And do you know when that was? The end of the 92 season, I think it was, at Anfield, when we beat them 2-0, Rashid scored, we denied them the league, Leeds had pipped them. Anfield was alive. It was such a wonderful gloat. But this was that was from a position of weakness, so I didn't enjoy that. This was a gloat from a position of strength, where they were just put in their place. I almost think the gloat is sort of needless in a way. They're laughing at Ollie.
The football did the job.
Yeah. In a way, we let the narrative be about Ollie. In fact, we don't want Ollie sacked. I kept wanting to go, shh, you know, stop saying Ollie's at the wheel. Long may it continue. The good thing is that I'm going all over the show here. I want them to win their very next football match, and maybe the one after that. We need some stability here for Ollie and that wheel. We don't want it going off the road. But let's get back to basics. It was truly glorious. It was wonderful and weird, and I didn't know quite what I was watching. It all made all the sense in the world and made no sense in equal measure.
I did something this morning with Totally Football, and the referenced the manager calling it insane. And I said, well, it's both sane and insane. Insane, obviously, because this doesn't happen. This sort of thing doesn't happen. But Liverpool yesterday, and in general, and I maintain, and have been for 3 or 4 years, are 5-0 better than Manchester United, Stu. They are 5-0 at Old Trafford better than Manchester United. And normally, football doesn't work like that. Teams raise the game. They find a little angle. The ball doesn't bounce for you. Yesterday, you got to see this Liverpool team is that much better than that Manchester United team. That was the truth of it on Sunday morning. It's the truth of it today on Monday morning. It is therefore perfectly sane that we go and do that. It's actually a football thing that it doesn't happen more often.
Yeah, that's right. To be honest, I was going to say something very similar, because, you know, on paper, and it's frustrating as well. Over the last few years, while we've been so much better than them, and then we've gone to Old Trafford, and we've not always performed as we could do. In fact, we never have, you know, until yesterday. You know, absolutely at our pomp. And it's very rare that all, you know, things like that come together. I'm 43 years old, and I was thinking to myself last night, actually, that's kind of irrelevant, because there's probably hardly anyone alive on the planet who, you know, has witnessed a greater Liverpool away performance than that. And I understand what you're saying as well, Rob, because what you do when you climb the mountain?
Yeah.
You know, it's a similar feeling as when I woke up the day after beating Barcelona. It's that kind of, or, you know, the day after we've won the league finally after waiting for so long, and it's this, you know, this full manifestation of all your wildest dreams in football. What can you do? Win the league, win the Champions League, to have the greatest comeback of all time. Beat Man United 5-0 in their own ground, we've done that. Beat Everton 5-0 at Goodison, we've done that too, you know, at some point. So, you know, it does feel like you're just checking off the bucket list.
Miracles, if you will. Someone should do a show about that.
Someone should do a show about that. So yeah, I mean, it defies belief, but it doesn't defy logic. You know, at its most brutal level, we saw the right thing happen yesterday. We saw an incredible team absolutely expose, dismantle, undress Manchester United in front of their own sorry fans, and it was a thing of beauty.
Josh Sexton was there and was on the aisle afterwards. I say that to sort of give you a forewarning of what his voice is going to sound like here. It was a humiliation, Josh. It really was. I tried to imagine being on the other end of it, and I think I wouldn't be able to get out of bed this morning, to be frank. As it was, I absolutely skipped out of bed this morning. It transpires that 5-0 wins at Old Trafford can defeat hangovers better than ibuprofen. That's currently where I am. It was.
I'm picturing you with a gimp mask on. Only that level of humiliation would have been equivalent.
It was a pleasure. It must have been a pleasure to be there. I wasn't, you were. How special was it?
Just absolutely unreal. As you can tell, you said this morning, the voice tells a story, and the voice is absolutely telling the story right now. It was strange, really. It was Robbo mentioned on the post match pint, I think, having one of those moments in the ground, and sometimes when you talk about it, it's almost like you're like trying to be poetic or saying something for the sake of saying it. But there was points in the game yesterday where I was like stood there and just looking on the pitch and being like, what am I witnessing here? Like almost trying to like soak in the moment, because it was genuinely hard to comprehend it all, really. As you can tell in the voice, I screamed myself hoarse in the ground and then also in the pub afterwards.
Everything went to plan, Josh. I'm going to come back to you mainly because I'm a torturous bastard. Everything went to plan, Josh.
A big swig of the lemon tea, though.
Yeah, hang on in there. There's some big calls from the manager, and it's worth dwelling on that. When the team dropped in different WhatsApp groups, when it was rumoured, I'm sure, I think everyone was a bit, oh, hello, this was not what we expected. And I was watching it with a couple of people, and when I said, this is the team, and when it came through on the BBC, the first thing was, well, what's the bench? It was that sort of team. The massive calls from the manager, and he is absolutely vindicated in every single one of them.
100%, yeah. I think the one I was almost worried about the most was Konate. I fully expected the Cater situation to be the way it was. I fully expected him to start Cater again. He's not the sort of manager who doubles down on a player when they've been sort of put down, if you get what I mean. Like, he wouldn't take Cater off at half-time in the week and then not start him in this game. I think he was always going to start Cater. The obvious surprise is the Fabinho injury, and hopefully that's not sort of too serious. But yeah, Konate was the big surprise for me. It shows that he must be doing something in training, which is putting him ahead of Joe Gomez in the pecking order for now. But, I mean, he did absolutely everything you expected of him and more. I love so much the little scrap after the Ronaldo Curtis Jones thing. Kanate's role in that, like Fred comes in like scrappy do, and Konate sort of just like grabs him and he's like, lad, no, come on, don't be silly.
Around that's just to use that as a jumping off point to talk a bit about the actual game, Stu, a tiny little bit. That I was watching it, I'm very much a 2-0, I was like, right, can we just get to half time? Then a 3-0, I was like, right, let's just get to half time. But what's striking about the third and fourth goals is that Liverpool are just almost walking through them. I don't think for the fourth, I think only Jota really runs a little bit. No other Liverpool player appears to run. You should not score goals in any football matches without there being an element of running. And yet no one does. And Manchester United just cannot get near Liverpool. And it's insane. It's berserk to watch. It made no sense at all. For the third and fourth, it felt like Liverpool just wandered the ball through them and it ended up in the Manchester United net.
Yeah, I think in midweek after the Atalanta game, I think Paul Scholes called it absolutely right, and that being one of two things he's come to my attention for over the last few days.
We'll gloss over the other one.
Yep, and you know what he said was, you know, that kind of performance against, you know, a better team, a really good team, you know, you'll just absolutely get exposed, and he was dead right. They're a bit of a mess, Man United, you know, to be polite about it. You know, I think they don't know what they are. They've got this idea of what they should be. They want to be this front-footed team, but they just don't have the players to do it, and they clearly haven't been coached to do it. They're trying to, it would seem, transform themselves, you know, from this counter-attacking team to a front-footed team. But then that was all blown apart when they brought in Ronaldo. And we could go down and digress, you know, quite a little bit around, you know, their shape and what have you. But they're not equipped, they're not coached to be able to cope with a team like Liverpool. And when you look at Liverpool's shape all the way through, it's so disciplined, even against a team as a mess of Man United are at the moment. And the reason that Liverpool are able to walk through is because every player knows what to do.
Yeah.
And they cannot believe what's opening up in front of them. They just cannot believe it.
That starts with the first goal. Rob, the first goal almost... Where are all the Manchester United players? Like, there's almost a point within it where, like, if Keita had turned around and gone, hang on, this something can't be right here. Like, everyone's well onside. But how is everyone... They're not just onside a little bit. Everyone's like a yard and a half, 2 yards onside. And there is literally no one there. I actually felt a bit sorry for Luke Shaw as he was getting played over and over. And people were saying Luke Shaw got sucked in. But someone had to go and play centre-half because the rest of them had got out the way. And there is a little bit of a question here about, firstly, us being in their heads, Salah being in their heads, us being very good, them being very bad, where those lines are drawn. That first goal, it's a terrible goal to concede. It looks like a counter-attack and it's not even a counter-attack.
It looks like a training ground exercise where he goes, we haven't got any actual opposition here, but you all stand in the right places and we'll just show you how the ball funnels from this. Because it starts with the goalie.
Yeah.
It's from our point of view, it's an incredibly brilliant team goal. Much, you know, you could put it on the par with those legendary ones like the McDermott one that he scores against Spurs, but none of us actually stopped to look at what Spurs are doing in that. If you stop to look, as you've just done, Leo, what Man United do in that goal, it's bizarre. There's like a 15-yard exclusion zone around all of our players as the move progresses. It's unnatural. It is almost unnatural. Yeah, I don't know what else to say about it, but what a wonderful... Even the finish from Naby Keita, which when you watch it back... He has the time to almost take it like a penalty.
Yeah.
He's been put clean through. The keeper should be charging at him. He should be about to feel the defender's breath or clatter. Or he could be clattered in some way. He has the chance to feign to finish to De Gea's right and then goes to his left, opens his body out. It's just too bizarre, the whole thing.
This is what happens when you've got a manager who's telling his players to press, but it's off the cuff. You can see it's not coached. And I think there's been a number of analysis of these, of how Man United are pressing and they're not going together, but it's also the angles that they press from. So they're making it so easy. Liverpool are, you were saying before, Neil, about the Liverpool can walk through them. And it's because the angles of Man United's, you know, attempted press, there's just no thought to it. It's basic. It's the kind of stuff that you would say to a kids team, at half-time, get into them, chase after them, close them down. And that's literally all they're doing. So from Liverpool's point of view, who are highly skilled, highly schooled in understanding the angles of a press and how to get through one as well as how to put one on a team, it was like a hot knife through butter. I mean, you're talking about a 15-yard exclusion zone around the Liverpool place, but there's a reason for that, isn't it? And it's because it's so easy for the man on the ball to pick a pass. It's so easy because the angles that they're getting closed down on are just non-existent.
But our movement is there as well. We have to add this, by the way. Incredible.
I'll come back to you on that, Rob. The movement is exceptional. The manager goes out of his way post-match to praise Firmino. And I think Firmino, all game, just keeps going into places they do not, they've not planned for him to be, they don't want him to be. Even when it's as simple as he comes and just adds an extra body in midfield at time and takes a simple sort of 5-yard ball. Firstly, they don't have anyone doing that in the whole of their team in the same way. But the second thing is that he's able just to drag people out of position over and over. And the manager went out of his way to say he almost redefines the way you play the false number nine position post-match. I thought it was really interesting the extent to which he went out of his way to praise Roberto Firmino, because he's seeing what Stu's just described there.
Yeah, and interestingly, though, it's a game where I don't think Bobby gets a shot away, or if he does, it's maybe one blocked one, but he doesn't, you know, we've seen him scoring goals recently, we've seen him getting shots away, he doesn't get one away. And to my mind, he's been... I think why Klopp's particularly happy is I think he's asked to play much more of a, let's be honest, a midfield role. And I think Keita is the surprise package in extent. He's backed him, but he's given him yet slightly less responsibility defensively, because I'm not saying he's quite got a free role, but Naby Keita is involved in all of the first three goals, I think. I think it's an assist, a score, and a pre-assist, the key thing, in the first three goals. He's running free and wild, Naby Keita, and that's, I think, a lot to do with what the license given by Roberto Firmino's positioning.
We've got the best player in the world, and he's very much in their heads. I think as a whole, Liverpool were massively in their heads. The first goal, in lots of ways, is the worst possible thing that can happen to Manchester United, because those players who aren't sure about what they're doing, suddenly the whole plan is undone, and they know Liverpool can do this almost at will. They have a couple of forays, I think, Man United, and it's worth remembering there's the Bruno chance just before we make it 1-0, Josh. But the best player in the world is on the pitch, and they know it. And I think this is something that I think is relatively unique from a Liverpool point of view.
Yes, it's an interesting one, really, because I think Manchester United down the years have been one of the teams who actually dealt better with Salah on the whole. I remember when they had Ashley Young at left back, and that was in the season when Salah was just, you know, I think he scored 44 goals in the end in his first season. And Ashley Young was like, basically had him in his back pocket all game. Luke Shaw's done it before as well, but they were managers who had a plan for Mo Salah. I get the feeling, like as Stu said before, that Ollie's telling them things and not actually coaching them. I think he's drummed them up for this game. Is what I think's happened. I think he's emphasised the importance of it and how sort of big it is, how large scale it is for how important it is for them to be beating Liverpool, particularly in the sort of, you know, the Fettel they're in, which is not fine Fettel, I must say. And that's the way they've sort of approached the game. That's the way that you know they're sulking on the pitch when the goals go in. Ronaldo's walking as Liverpool are passing it around at the end. It's just like every single bit of United's approach to the game was just completely off.
Can I just make the point about them, Neil? It just occurred to me yesterday. I think the last time that we played them in our title winning season, when that we drew with them, and we went there and they're very defensive, but they're on the back of quite a run at that stage. They're doing well, if I remember rightly. And I think we were all a bit surprised that they were so unambitious, but it worked for them. And I was surprised. I thought coming into this one, they're in a bad state. They're going to be compact and quite defensive and look to use their talents, their pace on the break to eventually damage us. But they will look to suck us in. But that didn't happen. To me, they looked like a team who'd taken some blows recently and felt they needed to put on a show for their crowd and come out swinging because they'd been slagged off. And they just fell between every stool you can fall between and were nowhere.
I really disagree with your statement, Neil, about how much Salah was in their heads, you know, because I actually think he wasn't in their heads enough. I actually think there's a real naivety of they can be gung-ho against us and at their ground they can get after us and show us who's boss. I think if Salah had been in their heads in appropriate amounts, they'd have done what they've done before. They'd have played five at the back, they'd have played Luke Shaw as a left-sided centre-half, where he's done really, really well against Mo, and they'd have closed those out-to-win runs, the space for those out-to-win runs for Mo. But actually, I think they were like laying themselves on the line and thinking, we'll go toe-to-toe with you. And that was, I mean, that was a flawed logic, wasn't it? You know what I mean? So, anyway.
Just on him in general, Stu, he's excellent in all phases of the game. The key thing for me is the graft. That it all stems back from that. The managers talked a lot about all of his players, that they show the requisite humility and all of that sort of stuff, that he's been saying that they show that in training and they're there every single day. And for me, it's tone setting stuff. Ultimately, he is the best player in the world, but he works like he's the worst one. He is desperate to be involved. He wants the ball all the time, but he's prepared to go and fight for it. You know, he's great out of possession. He's obviously brilliant in possession. You genuinely couldn't be more impressed with a footballer than I think we all are at the minute with him. He gets a hat-trick at Old Trafford. It's a huge statement, and I wasn't thinking this would be a game for statements, but I think you are right that Manchester United were trying to make one, and in the end it's gone very, very badly wrong for them. But he has just very much announced to the world, if anyone was still in any shadow of a doubt, that currently he is the best of them. He is the best player.
When you sign a player, you very quickly, you know, you're watching the YouTube videos of him, you know, at his former club. But you're very, very quickly making assessments when they sign of what their ceiling could be, what their potential could be, and you invest heavily in that. And if they're a really good player, you know, you open your heart and you're all in, and you're proclaiming that this fella's going to be the greatest, you know, thing since sliced bread. But it's rare that happens, that a player actually lives up completely and utterly to their potential and in fact exceeds it. We're looking at a player now who is the perfect version of himself. This is not a flash in the pan. This is a player who has unlocked these abilities of his own here. That he's, if you look at the first season that he had, and he was, people didn't know how to handle him, and it was incredible. But then he's had, you know, an injury and then a couple of years where he's still done really, really great numbers, but maybe not quite found it as easy as the first season. And he's had to develop his game in different ways. And he's very, very self-analytical. You can see that in the rare interviews he gives. And you're now in a situation where he lives his life perfectly. He's completely dedicated to the game. We've heard this week how he is completely and utterly dedicated to Liverpool. You know, he's not interested in anything else other than Liverpool and the lads around him. And he has now just transformed. He's gone on to a different level, and it's a level that you could argue that we've never seen before in a red shirt.
It's what grabs me in that post-match interview that he gives yesterday is all he wants to talk about is the league title. That hat-trick's gone now. I've done that one. There's a league title to be won here. That to me comes out of all of them. You know, I think that that's absolutely central to all of them in a way that I think has been overlooked by certainly by the punditry in this country. But I would say, even to a certain extent at times, by Liverpool's own support, but in conversations around other things, this to me looks like a football team with a manager who are absolutely desperate to regain that league title. They have the best player, and all he wants to talk about is winning the league title. He doesn't want to talk about himself. He wants to talk about, we've got a league title to win here.
Yeah, I think we can't underestimate what a dent to all of their worldviews and perceptions of themselves last season was, ultimately, despite the good finish. I think they'd spent 3 years watching every single one of them on a similar journey, Trent Alexander-Arnold, Van Dijk, even Henderson, others, seeing themselves winning these elite trophies, seeing themselves being recognised, Henderson, double footballer of the years, as these elite footballers, and go, this is who I am now. And then suddenly it's taken away from you. Suddenly you're part of a team that gets beat 6 on the bounce at home. You're nowhere in the league. Suddenly it's all gone. And they realise in the blinking of an eye, all that they'd built up could be gone. And also, not just gone, but the previous achievements diminished because of it, because it seemed too quick. So the motivation, I think, is back with a bang and a new, more profound level. That these, and it's not just in one of them. Of course, Mo Salah goes, I want to win the Ballon d'Or. I want to be recognised as the greatest player in the world. But it makes sense in the context of being the greatest team in the world. I think they all know that. I think they're all buying into that. We are nothing as individuals without the team. And they seem like they're rediscovering that in a big way.
That's one of the reasons why the statement on the pitch is as grand as it is. That this is, yes, Salah gets the hat-trick, but he gets the hat-trick as part of this Liverpool team. And that's why it matters that he constantly shows that humility, that he himself will speak. You know, he knows how good he is, but he himself will speak about the team. He'll speak about the league title. It's in the whole performance, I think. It's even in that last half an hour when they decide almost as a team, we're just knocking this around at this point, Josh. For me, that is one of the reasons why, you know, they're capable of anything this year, I think. I think they're capable of the double. It's possible that they win neither of the big trophies because City and Chelsea look good. But this is a Liverpool team who right now, I'm saying, are capable of winning the league and the European Cup this season, and they should be afraid of no one. And they showed why yesterday.
Absolutely, yeah. And we've seen from this Liverpool side down the years that they learn every year upon year. They've sort of learned things. I remember the first season Klopp came in, that we were beating big teams and getting sort of, you know, frustrated by teams who were parking the bus. The season after that, I think our results against the big teams aren't as good, and we're battering all the sort of bus parking teams. It's a team that year upon year learns from its mistakes, learns from the things it does well as well, and just constantly keeps evolving and getting better. And I take Rob's point there as well. I think there was a sort of a really weird thing around last season, particularly with the injuries. I think all of a sudden the team that for so many years had looked and felt untouchable was all of a sudden completely sort of, you know,
touchable.
Yeah, touchable. Yeah, I think they felt like, you know, losing 6 on the bounce, all the best lads getting injured, and things just sort of, everything possible going against them in a way has now motivated them to do what they're doing now. And I think it shows in a performance like yesterday. You've got, you know, the one of the most complete away performances ever, a 5-0 win against Manchester United. But also, you know, in terms of like the VAR decisions and stuff that go Liverpool's way in the game, it's a team now that just feels like they're absolutely riding the crest of a wave and as you say, could literally do anything on sort of any front.
Yeah, I don't like to get ahead of ourselves. It's just like the gloating thing pulls at me. But
it's one game at a time, Robert. They know it's one game at a time, and they've done it before.
It is, and there were moments in the early phase of last season, and I know last season we were increasingly inclined to park it as an anomaly because there were no fans in the ground, but we weren't parking it as an anomaly when we went to Chelsea and did them so emphatically, or the tore Arsenal apart in the early stage, or dismantled Palace 7-0. We weren't treating it as an anomaly of a season, you know, or the glorious late win against Spurs. But that was a season that fell apart. And we'd had injuries also in the bit we managed to be stable. We're battling now with quite a reasonably big injury list. We ended the day with what, our only 3 fit senior midfielders on the pitch. Look, no notes of caution are, I'm stating the bleeding obvious here. Obviously, the foundation is there. We couldn't wish for anything more. We were at a point where we feel ready to go. I worry that you score sometimes like some City teams in the year that we finish ahead of them, or we nearly pip in the 98-point season. They did a lot of beating teams 5 and 6 nils, whereas Liverpool kept winning matches alongside that. So we do have to be cautious. We have to keep our feet on the ground and all that.
Are you enjoying this enough, Rob?
I won't until the race is run, you know, because yeah. I do enjoy it, but there's no prize apart from 3 points.
You're right, though. I can understand completely. You know, you don't want to be softened by the glory of the win. And I think, you know, going into the game, I actually thought that we had the perfect game going to Old Trafford. To go away to Atletico and to get that win there against that, you know, level of hostility, both, you know, in the stands and on the pitch and on the sideline from the crazy manager. I think, you know, after that, anything is pretty much a walk in the park, really. That's one of the toughest places to go in Europe. And let's be clear, right now, Old Trafford is not.
I think on the mounting injury list, the flip side of it, Stu, and that's why it was, the tackle's a disgrace, to be quite honest with you. And it wouldn't surprise me if the suspension is extended off the back of some sort of look or review on it. It's everything that you shouldn't be doing as a professional footballer. I actually thought Neville struck a really good note on the commentary. I'm often prone to laughing at Neville, but I think he strikes a really good note on the commentary around it, just that it's wholly out of order. It's pure petulance from Pogba. That said, up to that point, I thought it was Keita's certainly best big game for the Reds, if not best game for the Reds, not allowing for Mo Salah. He's probably man of the match at the moment that he gets hurt, which therefore means he's man of the match full stop, if you sort of know what I mean, because the way the game ebbs away, he was absolutely flying Keita. I thought he cruised through it, but with intensity, if you know what I mean. He rose above the game whilst dominating the game. I thought he was tremendous.
He was incredible. It was his best performance in Liverpool shirt by a mile. And, he's had a few good ones. But that level, I mean, Rob spoke about it earlier on, the level of press that he put on in the first half, him and Firmino, they didn't know what to do with them. I mean, they literally dismantled them, they took them apart, but it wasn't wild. It was so calculated, it was so clever. This is a guy who now, you know, he understands the job. Keita, that was, because there's been times at Liverpool with Keita when he's been in Liverpool's midfield, and I've sometimes wondered, is he picking it up? The movements, the necessary movements, is he grasping it? Because sometimes there's been a danger of him either emptying a position or getting caught in possession. But yesterday was perfection. You couldn't want more from a midfielder. It reminded me, some respect, his goal reminded me almost of Gundogan. From about a season or so ago, when he was absolutely flying and he was constantly making those third man runs from City's midfield, and also was great in the press. He's a cracking player, Gundogan, isn't he? So and Keita, you know, if he gets to that level, I mean, yesterday was a step beyond, I thought, and can sustain it, then we've got some player on our hands. But you know, we've just got to see how this injury is.
That's the blow on the injury, Rob. We'll get on when we talk about Preston in a little while to talk about the injury list as it's now hit.
Yeah,
for me, the blow on the injury is, you know, there'd have been an argument to start him against Preston. There certainly would have been a certainty you'd be starting him against Brighton. That, you know, with a bit of luck, this is just a contact thing. It's a bruise. It looks bad. We'll find out. But he's able to get back motoring, because it felt all of a sudden like you can see a run of games for this lad here. And it felt like the sort of performance that a footballer has at different phases of his career, where he has that one and then he doesn't look back. And that was what I was beginning to sort of, we were sort of chatting about it when we were watching the game, thinking if he builds on this, Liverpool could be, you know, he could be the dream number eight for Liverpool Football Club at this moment. I really hope that the news comes out today that it's effectively just a flesh wound, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it might just be heavy bruising, but that could keep him out for a couple of weeks. But you know, I hope it's no more than that. He's been, you know, the idea that he's a constant injury prone has been slightly put to bed, I think, because he probably hasn't had a significant injury in 6 months that hasn't made him miss more than a game or not be available for more than a game.
Call this one, if he's injured, about to be an injury prone. He gets done by a lad on the pitch.
But it'll be on his record, unfortunately. Yeah. That's the way people are about these things. But he did need the good fortune to go with, to enable him to harness his talent. And he's beginning to show it. He's an unusual footballer, Naby Keita, isn't he? He's at once a fantastic offensively defensive player. Because he is truly the pressing monster of law, right? He just truly is. So many times he is at the scene of the pre-assist crime, if you like. I mean, Salah's wonder goal against Watford is because of a Naby Keita. It doesn't happen without a Naby Keita press. I think the second goal doesn't happen without. As you said, him and Firmino in tandem are incredible like that. And he's really, really good at moving through the gears, getting you up the pitch. He's a fantastic dribbler. He's got incredible vision for a pass and weight of a pass. And he's actually a really, really special finisher quietly as well. Mm. But he's got one fatal flaw. He's not press resistant himself. Mm. He's not press resistant or even that press aware himself, which is a bizarre contradiction. And I think if you can harness that flaw and minimize it and exacerbate and sort of accentuate all his assets, then boy, and keep him fit, obviously, then boy, we've got a player, as you say.
Konate comes in, you mentioned him before. It's a big call from the manager and he's got his big calls right. I think it's an interesting one you said before about pecking order. I don't think it quite works like that. I think what he wanted was recovery pace and height up against Ronaldo. He wanted recovery pace and height, so therefore Konate just edges ahead of Gomez. I think there's also something else about Matip, which is that he's not that good at jumping, and Ronaldo is very, very good at jumping. It is his thing these days. But he plays well, a little bit mucky first 10, but I think, Josh, it's a really strong performance from him. Do him the world of good, and part of the idea that he knows he's part of a brilliant team and that brilliant team knows that he can be part of them is not to be sniffed at.
Absolutely, yeah. I was sort of at the game yesterday thinking that he needs just like a quiet first 10 where he gets on the ball a few times, he completes his passes, he wins a couple of headers, and he did that, but then he makes a mistake for one of their chances and I was like, oh, I hope he doesn't shit the bed now. And to be fair, he didn't, and I think that, you know, we always sort of damp our other centre half with faint praise whenever they play with Virgil van Dijk, because we probably want to give Virgil van Dijk all the praise in the world, and he deserves all the praise in the world again yesterday. But, you know, quietly this season, I mean, we're not even really doing it quietly, we're giving the other centre half, yep, the praise they deserve this season, and Konate deserved it yesterday. I thought he was great in the air, he was great in the pass. There's some times where he gets dragged out to the right-hand side a little bit, but I think him and Trent almost worked out a thing where,
yep,
Trent can fill in and sort of, you know, do that job for them. And then even the times where he was getting dragged in, he wasn't getting dragged in and then doing something daft, he was getting dragged in and he was winning the ball. And that's the sort of main thing, I think, is that if you're going to commit and if you're going to, you know, put yourself on the line, your position on the line, particularly in a team the way the Liverpool are, and a team the way Liverpool press, you have to be able to win the ball. And, you know, he showed yesterday that he absolutely can do that.
I think it's a bit of a masterstroke picking Konate, and I know history vindicates that statement now, but I think the height thing is a massive factor. United are big, you know, Pogba, Maguire, Ronaldo, they can all, I think they probably watch, they have been increasingly more dangerous on set pieces. And they've probably seen how Ivan Toney did this as a big guy, just by simple flick-ons, because we defend a high line. So if the first attacker can flick it on, we've got a bit of a problem. Mm. And they probably thought, well, even Ollie might have seen that Brentford game, you know, and had a little think. Because I looked at that Brentford game and thought, this is crying out for Konate at a certain point in it, when you could see Matip getting done by Toney. I thought he's very, very good. You know, when you see, he's a fantastic physical centre half, in terms of he's as tall as you want, he's as broad as you want, he's quick as you want. To be able to put that all together though and actually be a competent footballer isn't easy. We see that, you know, we've seen that throughout history. And but I think he's an amazing prospect. I'd like us to persist with him. I mean, I would feel terribly sorry for Joe Gomez. I'd feel mortified for Joel Matip as well, but part of me thinks that he's the world's next best centre-back in waiting, Konate, and I'm desperate to find out quickly that that's true.
It's like having a lean heavyweight boxer, you know, in your back line, which, you know, is imposing, you know, no matter who you are, if you're Ronaldo or whoever. I thought it was interesting you mentioned, Josh, before about the sometimes him just covering for Trent a little bit. And I thought Ronaldo's disallowed goal, which, by the way, one of the greatest moments of my life, that disallowed goal,
it's better than all the goals.
Do you know why that was so enjoyable, especially in the ground it was enjoyable? Because United had the cheek to celebrate it.
Yeah.
Do you know why? Because it was in the pricks. It wasn't the biggest let-off, obviously, but there should have been no let-off. If that had been us at that, and Salah had bagged at 4-0 down at Anfield to Man U, it'd have been a ripple. That was a celebration of a goal. Bizarre.
I thought that he was too eager to cover space that wasn't needed, to be honest. He got too close to Trent, got sucked in, and it made it quite easy then for Ronaldo to step away into the space onto his favoured foot and lash it in. But I'm sure stuff like that, they'll eradicate, they'll sort it out. That's just about experience of playing alongside each other, isn't it? Knowing your teammates, that stuff will come. But, you know, Jesus Christ, has a set of physical attributes. And he's clearly got a brain as well. Mm. You know, he's a good footballer.
He can pass the ball.
He can pass the ball very aggressively, very vertically, can't he? He can split lines, much in the way that Matip does as well, to be fair. There's a lot of similarities between the two of them, but obviously he's just got a lot more brawn as well with it. What a prospect.
The goals in general, Rob. Firstly, I mean, the Henderson ball for the fifth is just
ridiculous.
It's absolutely exquisite. It really is. But in general, the goals, Liverpool are just not stopping scoring. This is yet another away game where they've scored three or more goals. At some point, you would think, but the truth of the matter is, they're not sort of wildly outstripping the underlying expected goals numbers or anything like that. They're just so endlessly creative. Mm. That to me is what must be terrifying for Guardiola and Tuchel, in a sense. You know, they're coming into this knowing pretty much every weekend Liverpool are going to create chances. Every weekend, whoever we're against now, no matter what team it is, if it's Atletico Madrid, Liverpool are going to create chances. Manchester City, Liverpool create chances. Only really the Chelsea game where Liverpool haven't created a large number of chances over the course of the game. And if you create chances, it leads to goals. It is some attacking form that we're in. Some attacking form.
Yeah, I mean, being ruthless in front of goal helps. But as you said, we're not really exceeding the XG. There's not worldies from Mane.
No, there's not 25. They're not 25 yarders. That's the point. They're not 25 yarders, these.
But I tell you what, we're seeing some epic assists, by the way. And you referenced it with the Jordan Henderson one. But we talked about the other week, the Salah to Mane one being like a Dalglish to Rush moment. Yeah. Well, that was as well.
Yeah.
And then some. It's strange. The team sort of from earlier on in the year that lost six at home, that... just felt like it had forgotten how to break down a side. It looked like other sides had realised there is a way to stop us. They were forcing our fullbacks to check inside time and time again. And I was sitting there thinking, we really need a new plan here. I don't quite know how we've got this plan back, but we seem to have. And it's, are we just half a yard quicker in the mind again because there's a crowd and the motivation and we've got... And again, people go, yes, you've got your real defenders back, so you're not having to stop and think. And it's long may it continue. I'd love to hear what Klopp and Linders and co were saying as to why there's this sudden sea change. Maybe it's just about having better personnel.
I think we've got really good at like targeting specific things in our game now. I think that the foundation that Liverpool have set is so strong that I think you see it in Keita's performance. You know, Stu, you mentioned him before, the sort of the press he was able to put on. And against Atletico, that was the thing that let him down, really, was that he was trying a bit too hard to press lads who wanted him to do it so they could dribble around him. I think you're seeing that with Liverpool now, that everything is becoming so targeted. I think they've probably looked at that Chelsea game and gone, well, why did we not create enough chances there? What can we be doing to make sure we're getting higher quality chances, make sure we're not just, you know, lashing it in from 25 yards? And I think that's you're seeing the fruit of that in the past few weeks.
Do you stop at five? In the 6-1 where City do them, Stu, it's 3-1 on about 85. In terms of big defeats to rivals that Manchester City have suffered, this is completely different. It's 5-0 when Pogba gets sent off. If anything, I think the sending off almost makes Liverpool go, you know what, we'll just keep the ball away from these because we're not having that again. We're not having another injured player. It's humiliating, the last 30 minutes, I think, for Manchester United. It's genuinely humiliating in a way that, touch wood, I'll never see a Liverpool side be humiliated in that way. To rest on the pitch at Old Trafford with the game well and truly in the bag, it was thoroughly enjoyable. You got the impression that Liverpool themselves were enjoying it, but it was also hugely professional.
Yeah, I mean, there's a real talent difference as well in that from the 6-1 that City did them with. And that was when Darren Fletcher got sent off, it was 2-1 to City. You know, so that game was not done.
Yeah,
our game was done. They were smoked when it was, when Pogba got sent off 5-0 down. I thought... What you're saying there about the second half and us letting them off the hook, I saw something from Sy Hughes yesterday comparing the Liverpool front line to Velociraptors, and I thought that was just a brilliant way to describe the situation, really. I mean, we were hungry, we were all over them, but the second half, once we were 5-0 up, I felt those Velociraptors had had the meal and now they were playing with the food. They were playing with the food, and that was enjoyable in itself. Really, that was really delightful. Yeah, we'd have liked to have maybe got 6-7, keep going for them. But there's an element of every one of those Man United fans knew that we were toying with them on their own ground. We were playing with our food, and you know,
lovely analogy. Yes, I enjoyed your analogy. It's true. I felt at 5 we would go, we're done here. We're done. I thought at 5 the priority was the clean sheet. Not 3 more, even the clean sheet. That they wanted it to feel not wild, not like anyone could go. In a way, the sending off, it's slightly spoiled. I was a bit. People won't remember that sending off happened at 5-0. Do you know what I mean? I thought, I want some more goals.
We'll make them remember.
We'll make them remember it happened at 5.
We will make them remember.
Do you remember there was that sequence of play where we had the ball for minutes on end? Minutes on end. We're back and forth. And what was great is I thought, This is taking the piss here. I wonder if we're going to do anything with it in the end. And we did. Do you remember? We didn't quite get in, but we nearly did. It was the most sort of, you know, that Matador metaphor you hear in football, where a team plays, they go from side to side, they wait, and then they strike with a vertical blow. We did that. It was a wonderful thing to happen. I wish there'd been a goal in the end of that bit.
I just love that the subs who came on, like Oxlade-Chamberlain and Mane, just really wanted to get themselves a goal.
Yeah.
Like every chance they got, every like little side to they had, they were like, I'm gonna have a go here. I'm gonna try for this. I said to you in the pub last night, Neil, I think I'm pleased they stopped to 5 because I genuinely think that 6 or 7 gets Ollie sacked. And like it's obviously not what Klopp and the players would be thinking about. And Klopp would have been, you know, full of respect for Manchester United, full of respect for their manager, and has been in the build up to the game, and will always be, because that's the sort of man he is. But there's an argument that 6 or 7 gets Ollie sacked, and that's the last thing we want.
Okay. Earlier today, I spoke to Maria Eagle about the process and the progress of Hillsborough Law. Very happy to be joined by Maria Eagle. She is the Member of Parliament for Garston and Halewood and has been since 1997. And through that process, she has been banging at the door around Hillsborough, around justice, and around the truth of what went on the 15th of April in 1989. There is now, Maria, there was an excellent, very long piece by David Conn in The Guardian that went through the ups and downs, the travails that the families have had to go through and the survivors have had to go through around the disaster in 1989. And one of the things that comes through in that piece is the extent to which the families and survivors have been failed by the justice process. You are campaigning and pushing for a change in the law called Hillsborough Law. Can you give us a description of what that law would do?
Yeah, well, first, I thought David's piece was excellent as well. I mean, and he always has been over the years. There's nobody knows more as a journalist than he does about what happened and what's gone wrong. And his piece was, as ever, excellent. The Hillsborough Laws really consists of two different sets of proposals. One is what Andy Burnham brought a private member's bill to the House about before he stepped down and didn't stand again. And that is having a statutory duty of candour on public authorities and also Equality of Arms Act inquests. Mm-hmm. And then there's my public advocate proposals, which are drafted to try and stop cover-ups, give agency to families in disasters, and make sure that that the kind of thing that's happened to the Hillsborough families can't ever happen again in any future disasters. And you've already mentioned Grenfell. I mean, there have been more disasters since Hillsborough. You can never rule out the possibility of future disasters. And so to have a mechanism that gives those affected the capacity to have a real say and to put a stop to cover-ups by shining a light, by transparency, by the Hillsborough Independent Panel type process, but at a much earlier stage, things don't go so horrifically wrong over decades. I think those things together would be a proper and useful legislative response to what's happened to try and stop it ever happening again. So that's the thing, that's what we're talking about, really, those three things.
Where is this process up to then? Where is the bill up to at this stage?
Well, the public advocate bill is stuck in the... I reintroduced it to the Commons. Michael Wills in the Lords and I, it's us that came up with the legislation, have been introducing it over a number of years. But because it's private members' business, not government business, we never get time. We can only get time for it if the government agree to it. So at the moment, last Friday, It was objected to again when I moved it by the government whips. But the thing is, we know that there is this other process going on in response to, now that all the final trials are over, in response to Bishop James Jones's report from 2017 into the lessons to be learned from Hillsborough. And there was a consultation in 2018, a government consultation, about introducing a public advocate, because Theresa May, who was the Prime Minister at the time, is quite keen on the idea. And it was in her manifesto, actually. It's been dropped since, but we hope that's an oversight. So there is a process going on in government by which they are considering what needs to be done to learn the lessons of Hillsborough. So there's my bill and there's that. And between the two of them, I hope that we can persuade ministers that they need to introduce all of those three measures as a response to the final end of the effort at gaining justice through the court.
The previous Justice Secretary back in June made noises that seemed as though he was talking about opportunities to review the law, called what had happened a catastrophic failure of the legal system. But he's no longer the Justice Secretary now. Is the hope that that will return at some point in the near future? And can people listening to this, you know, if they contact their members of parliament about something like this, is that worth them doing in order to heap pressure wherever they are in the country?
Yes,
in order to heap pressure on the government?
It definitely is worth doing, actually, yeah. Especially if you've got a Tory MP, because they obviously feed in a bit more directly to the government in informal ways than Labour MPs can. We can write and we can ask for meetings and we can make representations. We do all of that. But obviously on the Tory side, certainly with this government, they seem to listen a bit more to their own, let me put it that way. So, yes, I would encourage people to write and support the public advocate bill and the Hillsborough law measures that are being considered by the government at the moment. It was a blow that the reshuffle happened on the very day of the debate, because I know that Robert Buckland, the previous Lord Chancellor, was wanting to do this. Dominic Raab, the new Lord Chancellor, I don't know yet whether he wants to do it. I'll be seeking to find out. Reshuffles always, they slow things down because the new minister, whoever it is, and however sympathetic they are to what you want to do, they've got to get their feet under the table. They've got to read the briefs. They've got to work out what their priorities are. So it always slows you down when there's a reshuffle. But the Home Office, who were looking at the Bishop James's report, they didn't have a reshuffle. So perhaps things are moving a bit faster there. So we just have to recalibrate and go back to the new people and keep pressing them. We did hear in the debate on the 16th from the minister who replied, Alex Chalk, who was also reshuffled, but he was reshuffled still into a legal role as Solicitor General. But he was also reshuffled. But he did say, he gave us a timescale for what the government's consideration of the consultation is of the end of the year. That's probably the timescale we've got. So the time is now. I think if we don't manage to persuade them to do it by the end of this year, that sets us back a lot more. So there is still an opportunity for us that we need to press them on. Get this done and get it done as a response to what's happened this year with the ending of all the legal efforts, the criminal trials.
You're going to be moving the bill again on Friday the 19th of November, is
yes,
that right?
I am. And before that, next Thursday, there's a debate in Westminster Hall about a report that the Justice Select Committee produced into the Coroner's Court. And I'm on the Justice Select Committee, and there were some proposals in that which mirror some of the Hillsborough law proposals. So that proposes equality of arms at inquests, mm-hmm, and duty of candour stuff. So there's all kinds of opportunities that we can still take and that I will take next Thursday to press the government minister who responds to that debate on these issues. If your listeners can think about writing to their MPs in support of these proposals, all this pressure helps.
Excellent stuff. Thank you very much to Maria. Let's get back into the room. Welcome back. Thank you very much to Maria for her time as ever. looking ahead to Preston, Rob, but talking about the injuries, Elliot Keita, Milner, Fabinho and Thiago, you would think aren't going to be featuring against Preston. They're Liverpool's only injuries. It's not dissimilar to last season with the centre-halves. The one thing that is different, obviously, is the quality of those who remain. They're not footballers you're in any way, shape or form concerned about playing for Liverpool at this point. There is still the three of them, but it makes it... I think he would have played anyway, to be quite honest with you. But he was impressive in the second half against Norwich, Tyler Morton, and I think he will be expected to start this one to give, at the very least, his captain a rest. And it wouldn't surprise me if another under-23, under-18 player also features in the middle of the park.
Yeah, it is a mad thing to be saying, but I think Tyler Morton's almost the first name on the team sheet. I'm not even joking, because almost everyone else... You go, well, hang on, apart from, okay, you can start going, Joe Gomez has got to get a game, but virtually everyone else you can think of, you go, well, there's more, whoa, we might need him at the weekend. So, for example, we finish at Old Trafford, only three senior fit midfielders, as we said, Henderson, Curtis Jones and Oxlade-Chamberlain. Now, at the moment, of that list of injuries you've just given there, none of them are certain to be fit for Brighton at the weekend as things stand. Not one of them can we be certain of. There's a chance one or two could come back into the reckoning, but I don't think Klopp will know that for sure, even this morning. So that means, do you want to let any of those three lads be risked against Preston? Arguably, no. So as you say, it's not just Tyler Morton
who's...
You've
got to give Chamberlain the game. He needs to play a game of football.
And you have the option of playing four forward. So
and you have
not,
five subs.
Yes, yeah, you do have to give Chamberlain again. I mean, Curtis has not played much football now in the last 3 weeks because he was injured for most of the international break and he only got a sub appearance there and a sub appearance in the week as well, I think. So there's a reasonable case for giving Curtis and Alex an hour with Tyler Morton at the base of the midfield, I would say. But after that, is it Leighton Clarkson?
Clarkson's away on loan.
Oh, he's away on loan. Jake Kane's still with us.
He's on loan as well.
Well, there you go. Looks like Balaghizi's dream debut is looming.
That's the issue, really, is that there's not a midfielder who's sort of close enough to the first team. The young lad who's been training with the first team, not this season, Dixon Bonner, but he almost went to Portsmouth in the summer. So I could see him being on the bench, but I couldn't see him getting a start in this one. I think it would be the logical thing to do, really, is to start Curtis and Chamberlain and Morton. I think that's what I go with.
Up front, last time out against Norwich, it's Minamino, Origi and Gordon. I don't see that changing, Stu, to be honest with you. Minamino, Origi and Gordon could all do with the game. Also, it's possible that Liverpool might look at 4-2-3-1, either in this one or against Brighton. But I think for this, it's going to be Minamino, Origi and Gordon. I think if you're Gordon, you'd be disappointed. If you're Gordon, you'd be disappointed if you don't get called on for this.
Yeah, all three of them are going to play. They've all got to play. And they should be licking the lips at it as well, you know. Origi's looked great from what we've seen of him when he's played this season. And I think, you know, he should be really fancying his chance of absolutely bulldozing Preston if he can get himself psyched up for it. And Minamino, again, you know, he's just a fella who needs games, doesn't he? He needs games. And I'm looking forward to seeing him. I'm looking forward to seeing him. And I'm obviously really excited every chance you get to see Gordon. You know what? He looks a real prospect.
The only question is fitness, Gordon. He's not been playing for a couple of weeks. The 23s played at Anfield last week, and Paul Glatzel was like called back from his loan at Tranmere to play. So that would be the only question mark, I think, would be around Gordon's fitness.
Bradley, can you get this knowledge, by the way?
Oh, I know.
Mateusz Mazielowski, is that correct, Josh?
Yeah.
Is he off borderline for a bench place?
Maybe for a bench place. He's to be honest, he's not had the best start to the season. There's a few other lads who I think will probably be ahead of him in the sort of, you know, the senior pecking order, if you will. He was obviously around the first team in the summer, but yeah, there'll be a few others I think they'd call on before him.
Would Balaghizi be one of them?
I think so, yeah. But Balaghizi, he's not necessarily a forward option. He definitely isn't a forward option at senior level. I think he's
no, I mean,
firmly, firmly
number
in
eight,
field,
though.
Yeah.
Bradley will presumably start at right back. And then, in fact, Nico Williams is back in the fold now. Back fit. Williams presumably gets in ahead of Bradley. Bradley, therefore, on the bench. Shimikas left back. And centre-halves, Josh, who do you reckon he'll pick?
He's got to go Gomez now, hasn't he?
He's got to pick Gomez.
There's an argument to maybe you do Konate again,
yeah.
and then you give yourself a Matip move at the weekend. The only question, I suppose, is that Ian Barraclough, the Northern Ireland manager, he said he'd been having a chat with Klopp about Conor Bradley's position, and they both see him as a midfielder at some point. So there's a bit of a question around maybe whether you have Conor Bradley on the bench as a sort of backup midfielder in case anything goes wrong, or whether, you know, he goes completely sort of balls to the wall and gives him the start in this one. But Nico Williams is he would be the shoo-in for me. He needs games as well, and he looked good against Watford when he came on. He looked good in, was it Porto, I think, he comes on another game, yep. And looks good as well. He comes on as a right winger in one of the games, doesn't he, and looks so good. So I think he'd be the one you start in this, and another opportunity for us to see Kelleher as well.
Yeah, Kelleher in goal, Shivercastle left back.
Kelleher wasn't on the bench?
Wasn't on the bench.
Was he injured?
Nothing's come out.
Okay. Well, anyway, I mean, the five sub thing I think is important for Wednesday night. I actually think Mane and Jota might get some minutes in as much room. Sadio was rested. Jota has been rested, if you want to call it that. Or Firmino has taken his place partially. So he may think there's, if you don't want to have to give Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain 90 minutes, for example, or Curtis Jones, that you could make some changes using the forwards later on.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed to Maria for joining us, and also in the room, Stu Wright, Rob Gutman, Josh Sexton, Andy Heaton producing this. It's been an absolute pleasure. It was an absolute pleasure yesterday. If you get the chance, subscribe to the Anfield Wrap, not least for One for the Future, which Josh hosts, which means he knows all about the 18s and 23s and goes and watches them all the time. That's useful. But also all of our post-match Manchester United stuff will be a riotous time. The stuff that was done yesterday on the way out from the ground was absolutely terrific. It's very much all worth listening to. It's the sound of people enjoying themselves. For now, though, we can reflect. Madame Tussauds United 0, the Velociraptors 5. See you later. Podcast Network.